This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock this week. Check this out. Our first guest, a well-known Australian biologist, reacts to his findings on extinction.
That paper shocked me. Now, I get bad news every day. The world is in an extinction spiral right now. Environmental degradation is happening across the board. And I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm talking about deforestation and pollution and feral species, invasive species, the loss of insects. The list goes on. Climate change is a very strong stressor in a system that's already highly stressed. But when we did this paper, I had to sit back and go, wow, I did not expect it to be this bad. Now, there's even a scarier story in all this. To me, that just means that, you know, from these kinds of models and what we know about the fossil record, that we are pushing dangerously close to an extinction event that would, you know, certainly see our extinction, but probably most other species. Will life persist? Of course it will. Will there be species afterwards? Yes, but we might talk about millions of years of regeneration and speciation.
That is Dr. Corey Bradshaw, coming up in just a few seconds. Later, you hear a great new action song from Sweden, followed by an intimate chat with one of the foremost climate scientists in the world, Dr. Phil Jones, from the University of East Anglia in the UK. I'm Alex Smith. This is Free Climate Radio in a world running out of time. We are living in a time of mass extinction of species, large and small. How serious is that? What are the rules of extinction? Two scientists, Italian and Australian, investigated that. Their study, published in Nature November 2018, contains unpleasant surprises. Our guest is Dr. Corey Bradshaw. He is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology at Flinders University in South Australia. Corey has published at least 300 papers and 3 books. His latest is The Effective Scientist, A Handy Guide to a Successful Academic Career. That's published by Cambridge University Press in March 2018. From Adelaide, Corey Bradshaw, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Looking over your past papers, extinction is not a new subject for you. What stimulated you and Giovanni Strona to investigate biological collapse in your recent paper?
There's actually an interesting story behind this paper that probably escaped most people's attention. So what happened was we were, you know, going through our normal sort of daily routines a couple of years ago and came across a paper that had just been published in the same journal, in fact, Scientific Reports, which is a Nature journal, that said that the Earth can take a lot of shocks. And yes, you might lose a lot of species, but there are a few species out there that are what we call extremophiles, and they can live in extreme environments that would kill most other beings. So you can think of things like the deep vent giant worms that grow on the bottom of the seafloor at sort of places like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, or you can think about certain types of bacteria. But there's one species in particular that is, I guess, a bit notorious for its ability to be an extremophile, and those are tardigrades. The tardigrades are, for most people who might not know that word, the little water bears is a common name in English. They're more or less microscopic animals that tend to live in the soil. They're beautiful animals. They're bizarre-looking things. They kind of look cute and cuddly when you put them under a microscope. They don't really have a jaw. They have this sort of circular aperture that with teeth-like structures around it, and they have these little hook claws and a fat little squishy body. They're very cute. But what these things can do is they can desiccate, that is, dry out. They can be exposed to extreme heat or extreme cold. You can even shoot them into space, and they can survive. So the authors of this particular paper took these, what we call thermal tolerances, these temperature, the ability to withstand extreme temperatures, and tested what these tardigrades were able to do. And it's true, you can put them through all sorts of horrible conditions, and they can survive. So their conclusion was that the Earth could, you know, be hit by a meteor or go through a nuclear winter or heat up by, you know, 50 degrees, and you'd still have tardigrades around. Everything else would be gone, but tardigrades would still be around. Now, that's interesting if you look simply from the physiological perspective, but as an ecologist, and several of my colleagues, including Giovanni, said, well, this is a bit ridiculous because tardigrades don't live in a vacuum. They have to eat things, and they have to survive within ecosystems, right? So we said, well, what would be the kinds of extinction rates that one might expect if we did what we should do is link all of the species together in what we call food webs, or these networks, these ecological networks. So who eats whom? Well, you can add more things than just the eating component. You can think of things like competition or pollination. So species depend on each other. Predators depend on their prey. Flowering plants depend on their pollinators, and so on and so forth. And so we did we basically decided to generate these virtual Earths, to use computers to, obviously it's a simplification to a certain extent because we can't model every species on the planet, but we did create virtual Earths that had the same kind of characteristics as ecosystems do today. And when we pushed the system towards a heating event or towards a cooling event, so the heating event's, you know, synonymous with things like climate change, or cooling could be something like an asteroid hitting us and going into a kind of a nuclear winter scenario. When you did this, we looked at the extinction rates simply from species dropping off the perch as they exceeded these thermal tolerances, these thresholds of maximum or minimum temperature. And then we also looked at what the extinctions would be if the so-called extinction cascades were taken into account. So if you lose, for example, a prey species, then the predator would go extinct, and so on and so forth. And it had all sorts of issues about dispersal and adaptation and competition and so on and so forth. We also had latitudinal gradients like a real Earth. And we did thousands and thousands of these Earths in different iterations. When we did this, it turns out that the extinction rates, including the extinction cascades, actually were about 10 times higher than what you'd expect simply from the warming or the cooling.
And that key concept which you bring out in the paper is called co-extinction, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So co-extinction just means that if one thing goes extinct, there are going to be other things that depend on it that go extinct. So that's the co-extinction, or the extinction cascade.
Right, and I think that in previous studies and in all of our minds, we think, well, we could just study the upper tolerance for heat by carrying some plant or animal inside and turning up the thermostat and seeing when they fail to reproduce or just die. But that isn't going to work because of the very reasons you just described.
Exactly. And, you know, it's pretty basic stuff, really, for ecologists. But for most other people don't actually consider those linkages. It did come a bit of a shock. But I'll tell you this right now. That paper shocked me. Now, I get bad news every day. The world is in an extinction spiral right now. Environmental degradation is happening across the board, and I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm talking about deforestation and pollution and feral species, invasive species, the loss of insects. The list goes on. Climate change is a very strong stressor in a system that's already highly stressed. But when we did this paper, I had to sit back and go, "Wow, I did not expect it to be this bad." Now, there's even a scarier story in all this. It's not just the fact that the extinction rates are probably 10 times underestimated if we just look at the thermal tolerances. If we take those networks now, and this is what we did also in the paper, and you deliberately pretend to be a super being and try to make the system go extinct as fast as possible. So what we did here was we just took the most important species in the network, which are generally the ones that are more connected in the network, so they influence more species. And we take the most connected node in this network, species, and we make that go extinct. Now, these are computer experiments, obviously. This isn't in the real world. And then we take the second most important species, and we knock that out. And then we take the third most, and so on and so forth. We can then compare that to a sort of a random extinction process where we just take nodes out at random, or we can then look at the extreme cold or the extreme warming scenarios. And as it turns out, the warming scenario mimicked almost exactly the worst-case scenario where we knocked out the most important species first. In other words, warming is pretty much the worst thing that can happen to an ecosystem. And that kind of follows what we've been finding. And I do a lot of paleo work as well, so looking at extinctions of mammoths and diprotodons in Australia and various things over the last, you know, several hundred thousand years. And what's coming out is it's not the cold events. It's the warm events that are causing extinctions, in addition to human stresses, of course. Usually it's a 1-2 punch. But unlike, you know, the Ice Age films that I'm sure that most of us have seen or at least been forced to watch by our children or grandchildren, it's not the ice ages that cause extinctions. It's in fact the warming periods thereafter. And that's the really scary thing, because it's exactly the situation we're in now. Highly stressed planet already from human intervention and human endeavor that's rapidly heating. That is the perfect storm for extinctions.
So just to recap for listeners, rule one, during warming, the most ecologically important species go first. And rule two, global warming drives more species to extinction faster than global cooling. Are we good so far?
Yep, that's exactly right.
All right. Now, rule three, as I read it from your paper, is that during warming, plants tend to go extinct first. That seems counterintuitive. We're thinking, okay, the big animals are going to go first, but no?
Well, I mean, I'll ask your listeners to think about this. What's the one thing that plants generally can't do as well as animals?
Can't move.
Can't move. Yeah, exactly right. So because, I mean, they can disperse, through seed dispersal, and they can grow vegetatively and increase their distributions that way. But if things start to warm up, an animal just goes, well, this is uncomfortable. I'm going to move over there. And you can think about that over generational or even evolutionary timescales. Whereas a plant, it's a lot more restricted. Now, some plants are very good at that. Certain weedy species can disperse very quickly, and usually it's helped by an animal distributor. You know, for example, like a buzzy on a certain small plant can get stuck to the feathers of a bird, and it can fly a long way and distribute the species that way. But most plants really can't adapt that quickly. So if you get in a rapid warming scenario in particular, the local thermal tolerances are exceeded very quickly. And so what you get is an overall range contraction because they just can't keep pace with that change. If the change is really slow, and I think this is another thing people don't quite understand, is that it's not just the magnitude of the change, it's the pace of the change or the rate of the change that matters. And we're going through one of the most rapid warming events in the last 2.5 million years.
I graze Australian media, and I came across in the journal called The Conversation an article just published called An End to Endings, How to Stop More Australian Species Going Extinct. Are we losing a lot of creatures from that rare Australian ecosphere?
We are, unfortunately, the world leader in mammal extinctions. That is, we've had more extinctions in the last few hundred years than any other country in the world, for mammals, that is. We also have some of the highest declines in bird species, about 60% decline in total bird abundance over the last 50 years. We do have insect declines, but unfortunately not great data to show just how much. But, you know, we're seeing these extinction declines across the planet. Recent work from Germany and Puerto Rico has shown very disturbing declines in all sorts of insects. And these are, of course, the basis of the food web for most species. Birds eat them, reptiles eat them, and so on and so forth. So we're seeing a wholesale collapse of our ecosystems. And Australia is a kind of an extreme place already. Most of Australia is a desert, more or less. And we have this thin strip of vegetation sort of around the coasts. And we have a very delicate ecosystem. We've also lost almost more of our species over the last 50, 60,000 years than any other continent. We have very few large predators left. And we were on this knife edge. With increasing bushfires and droughts and cyclone intensity, as well as more and more development into very sensitive ecosystems, we're just kind of pushing all of that remaining wildness to the corners of the continent, and eventually it's all going to collapse.
And some of it just doesn't exist anywhere else. And we haven't even talked about marine extinction as more heat waves roll around the coast of Australia and around the world. Marine heat waves are a big new topic. Do your models include marine life, and does co-extinction play a strong role there?
It does indeed. In this particular set of models that we did, we didn't really treat the marine environment simply because we have a different kind of thermal dynamic going on. Obviously, the specific heating capacity of water is quite different. However, I'm involved in several other projects that are showing the massive changes in the marine environment. For one, we're seeing our algae communities, our what we call macrophytes, so those that tend to be like the big kelps and things like that. We've seen wholesale shifts in communities by several degrees latitude over the last 40 or 50 years, especially on the east coast of Australia, because that's the East Australia Current is quite strong. And these pulses of warm water are coming down more frequently and descending more into the south. So essentially, the algae community off of the coast of Tasmania now is what used to be off the coast of Sydney 50 years ago. But I was just in Sydney last week, in fact, involved in another project looking at the tropicalization of the fish communities off of Sydney. So we were in lovely Manly, the very wealthy neighborhood, diving in this beautiful little bay, seeing large blue grouper and Maori wrasse and all sorts of things. But what was really interesting is we were diving, we were seeing these little sergeant fish, these things with the most wonderful genus name, Abu Deftaf, that are essentially from the Great Barrier Reef, thousands of kilometers north, and they're showing up every year more and more. There are now over 60 tropical species found in Sydney that were never found there before the early 2000s. And so this rapid shift is happening in some ways much more quickly in the marine environment because things displace a lot more quickly.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Australia. My guest is Dr. Corey Bradshaw from the Global Ecology Laboratory at Flinders University. So, Corey, within that concept of co-extinction, you portray different interdependent webs of life that help a lot of different creatures survive. But that interdependence also seems to offer a fragility that can bring the whole web down. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, so we ecologists often talk about things like functional redundancy. Now, that sounds like a fancy term, but essentially what it means is that there are different roles that different species play. For example, predators eat things and plants photosynthesize and certain things pollinate. And so everything has a specific role. Some things decompose dead flesh and so on and so forth. So everything has a role, and there are certain species that do the same role. And we call this functionally redundant. I mean, every species has a slightly different niche. In other words, it exploits a slightly different component of its ecosystem. But that internal diversity and that functional redundancy is what gives ecosystems a certain shock-absorbing capacity. So they can take a disturbance and they can bounce back from it. Now, that only goes to a certain amount. So if you lose two or three species that have a similar functional role, the entire ecosystem can continue to function reasonably well. But the more species you lose from those functionally redundant roles, the more susceptible it becomes. And eventually, once the last species in that particular functional role goes, you can have a cascading effect right throughout the entire food web that affects almost everything else. So you can shock these systems, and that's an evolved trait as well. These systems evolve this capacity to withstand shocks because they've gone through them through evolutionary time. And the different components of these ecosystems shift in terms of what species are there at any particular time and over geological time, but the overall function is roughly the same. But if you push it too much, you get these mass extinction events. And we've had at least 6 mass extinction events in the past, probably more closer to 100 that we can measure through the fossil record. And it doesn't take a lot to push them. In fact, our model suggests that even a small change, well, small in the grand scheme of things, a 5-degree shift could see that most species in the world go extinct simply through this combination of exceeding the thermal tolerance as well as the extinction cascade. Now, that actually matches a lot of the sort of the order of magnitude temperature changes that we can infer from the fossil record for the great extinctions during the Permian and also probably the most infamous being the Cretaceous when the big asteroid hit the Earth and the dinosaurs went extinct. Well, no, sorry, they didn't go extinct. They turned into birds. But we lost the big ones. And so these wholesale planetary shifts are actually fairly easy to precipitate.
And you also say co-extinctions are often triggered well before the complete loss of an entire species, so that even oscillations in the population size of a species could result in the local disappearance of other species. How would that work, and how do you know that?
Well, so looking at an entire ecosystem, we tend to simplify it to particular nodes where we don't take the overall abundance, for example, or the spatial distribution of a species into account. But I do a lot of population ecology as well, and one of the truisms of extinction is what we call the small versus the declining population paradigm. So as a population declines, and it can decline for a number of reasons. It can decline because people are exploiting it, or it can decline because of a disease. It can decline for a whole host of reasons. That process generally then turns them into small populations. Now, small populations are susceptible to events that wouldn't really make much difference to a large population. For example, there's a great example I always used like to give is the great auk. The great auk was, I guess, the Northern Hemisphere's version of a penguin. It was hunted for its eggs and its flesh through much of the last 500 years. And it was a, it's a large penguin-like looking bird. It could fly modestly, but not very well. And it was super abundant throughout much of the last 500 years, throughout most of the North Atlantic and parts of the Pacific. And because of its popularity for eggs and meat, it was systematically hunted down to small population sizes. Now, the last remaining population was on a little islet off the coast of Iceland, I think sort of near the end of the previous century. The dates I don't have exactly in my head. But this small population didn't go extinct. This was the last population, so the species didn't go extinct because of all of the hunting. That particular islet blew up in a volcanic eruption, and that was it for the species. Now, that volcanic eruption, had it happened when the species was abundant and distributed over a large area, wouldn't have made much of a difference. So you get different processes operating. These random or what we call stochastic factors become very important as populations get small, and you can get them wiped out entirely. Or if you have massive fragmentation in space, so you only have a little population here, a little population there, then a predator that, for example, that depends on those can't actually get to enough prey in time to be able to fulfill its own energy needs. And therefore, you can get, even though the extinction hasn't happened yet, it ceases to become to do its functional role in the ecosystem, and therefore you get cascades well before the extinction.
But even if we don't get hit by an asteroid or a great chain of volcanoes doesn't explode, am I getting from your paper that there's some sort of limit around 5 degrees centigrade warming where there could be the beginning of a biological end, at least of the species that we know and can see?
Yeah, and that I think that was one of the shocking parts of this, is that it doesn't actually take as much as you would think. Now, 5 degrees in a lot of ways is unfathomable for most people, but we're already sort of exceeding the 2, perhaps even 3 component with little chance of backtracking there or avoiding that. So 5 isn't really out of the realms of possibility in terms of over the next few centuries. Now, to me, that just means that, you know, from these kinds of models and what we know about the fossil record, that we are pushing dangerously close to an extinction event that would, you know, certainly see our extinction, but probably most other species. Will life persist? Of course it will. Will there be species afterwards? Yes, but we might talk about millions of years of regeneration and speciation. The Earth will go on until, of course, the sun does blow up or something, you know, more extreme that removes all life, but humans won't be around. And I think it's, you know, my colleague often says this, you know, the Earth will survive. Human society probably won't. And that's what scares me.
That's the direction we're heading now, but we could make an extreme turn, perhaps, and rework our energy system and so on. But you also discovered that scientists have had a kind of bias towards optimism because they left out this co-extinction factor.
Yeah, and, you know, as I said, most of my colleagues weren't terribly surprised by this paper, but they're ecologists. But when you talk to the average person and you paint that picture, just, you know, it's a lot worse than even the pessimists think. And I'm, you know, I've been in this job too long not to be a pessimist, but even when I can shock myself with my own work, I know that I'm onto something that's probably scarier than most people even care to appreciate. So it's, we're getting into not just the, okay, there's a problem. This is a serious problem, and it's much, much bigger than most people can possibly realize. And we're starting to get political momentum, you know, school strike for climate and Extinction Rebellion and various other movements, but it's not nearly enough and not fast enough. And you know, the human population isn't going to go away anytime soon in terms of our population growth over the next 100 years or so. So if anything, we're going to see more damage and more problems before it gets any better. I strongly suspect we're going to have to go through a major population crash before we have any capacity to be able to reverse or at least slow down some of these negative trends.
You're not the first scientist to tell me that on Radio EcoShock, but you do conclude that minimizing biodiversity loss is the best approach to preventing environmental collapse. Do we know how to save biodiversity?
Well, I think what we can do is probably, so the first thing is, of course, to do everything we can to limit the extent to which climate change is impacting the biosphere. But that's a political decision more than anything. I think in terms of smart management, this using models like these where we identify some of the most important species in those networks and putting more of our effort and our resources into saving those would be probably the smartest way to do it. So we're trying to maintain those strong functional roles within those ecosystems so that they can survive those shocks, those temperature shocks or those bushfire shocks or various other disturbances. So the more redundancy we have in the system, the more insurance we have. And that's, I think, what we have to focus on.
Mulling over your paper reminds me of that message so often printed on rearview mirrors. It says, objects may be closer than they appear. And it seems like the rules of extinction are almost hidden by the kind of consciousness that we have. We're very grasping. We think we know what's going on, but we don't. So I'm asking, did your study results stimulate new questions and concerns that you're now going to follow up on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a paper, most papers I write certainly generate more questions than they answer. That's just the reality of science. But yes, I'm certainly working on a lot of different kinds of network models now, both looking at past and future applications. So that's something that I've generated a lot of, you know, personal interest in. And I've got, you know, my entire lab is filled with people doing these sorts of things right now. So we're trying to get more of the complexity out of these systems just to identify which are the most important components that we need to keep around.
As we wrap up, tell us about your new science about the dingoes, the wild dogs of Australia.
Well, it's a paper that came out yesterday that just basically confirmed that the dingo is, in fact, a completely different species. It's in all respects, it's a native species of Australia and should be given protection because of it. But it's often considered just a wild dog that is vilified by especially the agricultural industry, and so it can be poisoned or shot or excluded with fencing. And we're just saying it deserves a very strong protection because it does play a very strong functional role in Australian ecosystems, and it needs to be protected if we want a chance of, again, increasing the resilience of the system. So that's generated a bit of controversy. I'm expecting to get some threats from people on email and online, but that's par for the course, really, in this business.
We've been speaking with Corey Bradshaw from the Global Ecology Lab at Flinders University in Australia. You can find links to all the science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much for your interesting questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This one goes out to planet Earth. One.
Listen, listen, there's a distant sound.
Yeah.
Coming closer soon, it's all around.
It's all around.
Hear me, time is running out.
Come on.
Come on, tell them what it's all about.
We're running out of time, running out of air. Gotta keep it clean, show me you care. Wherever you are, you gotta wake up.
Come on.
We got a job to do, so stand up.
Yeah.
Salute life, not the general. Play fair, with your morals. We can be united as the nations,
as the nations.
For our planet, running out of patience.
We ain't got no time. Come on.
We don't have time.
So we don't have no time now.
We don't have time.
So we don't have no time now. Yeah.
Time to act, we got a world to save.
Hey.
Right or wrong, now how will you behave?
Come on.
Do the right thing as they used to say. More than ever, that is true today.
Listen, you wanna be part of the solution? Switch it up for future generations. Level up, stop wasting.
Stop
you wanna know if that's water that you're tasting? Stop playing with our future. My daughter told me if our planet dies, then how would you console
me? Show me some responsibility.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's right, y'all, we don't have time
to ignore the signs.
We can't ignore it no more. We don't have
time.
You gotta make it right now. Make it happen right now.
We kids don't usually do what you tell us to do. We do what you do. And since you adults don't give a damn about my future, I won't either.
Together we can do it.
We don't have time to wait.
Come on, let's go!
We ain't got no time now.
To ignore the signs,
yeah,
no more.
Yeah.
Out the planet Earth.
You just heard We Don't Have Time, written by Ingemar Betoni Aberg, C.J. Palmer, and Adam Batiste, with a little Greta Thunberg on the track. On Earth Day, this April 22nd, you can visit the new social network for saving the climate and truly making a difference. Get a sneak preview at wedonthavetime.org. Next up, Phil Jones.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock, with your host, Alex Smith.
How do we know planet Earth really is warming? Well, partly because Dr. Phil D. Jones tracks temperature records from all over the world. Dr. Jones published hundreds of papers, which are highly cited in climate science. For 20 years in the UK, he directed the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now he is professorial fellow in the School of Environmental Sciences at the university. Phil Jones, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
You were awarded your doctorate in hydrology in 1977, and only 3 years later you began your life's work of collecting temperature records from around the world. Why did you, as a young hydrologist, pick that up?
Well, at the time in 1977, when I finished my PhD, or just before even, I was looking for a job. And I had applied for a number of jobs in the hydrology area, but I also applied for one in the Climatic Research Unit and in at University of East Anglia in Norwich, and that was the one I got. And it was very fortuitous for me personally and for my career. It was a very good area to get into at that time.
And in your 2001 book, History and Climate, Memories of the Future, it surprised me to find that even up to the mid-1970s, shortly before you got on board, scientists thought that humans lived in a fairly fixed climate, you know, at least within our time frames. So even that recently, science had to shake off the medieval view of a never-ending stable cycle with minor variations. That seems strange to me now.
But there was a belief that climate, for all intents and purposes at that time, in around the late 1970s, 1980, could be thought of as constant. So we design things like river works in towns to stop flooding and dams to provide agriculture with water. We designed them assuming that the year-to-year variations in climate were pretty much the same, and you could just assume that that was going to continue into the future. But there had been studies earlier, and going back to Fourier in France in the 1830s, but more recently in the 1890s by Svante Arrhenius in Sweden, that if you increased the number of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is the main one, then you would increase the temperature of the planet. And a number of people have worked on that during the 20th century. The first temperature record was produced by Vladimir Kirpin in the 1870s and 1880s. And another record was produced by Guy Stewart Callender in Britain in 1938 and 1961. And he also looked at the reason for the temperature increase that even he saw in his 1938 paper from the late 19th century. And he related that to carbon dioxide increases, and he also produced a record of carbon dioxide from measurements we'd made from expeditions to various places around the world of carbon dioxide concentrations from the late 19th century to about 1940, and he could see that it was going up. And that record is in pretty good agreement with the record that was later produced from ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic of carbon dioxide trapped in the bubbles of ice. So Callender did some amazing work. And in terms of the temperature work, you've got to bear in mind that he did it all by hand. I mean, what we can do now with digitized data and computers is we can calculate things amazingly quickly. But I think Callender, it probably took Callender a couple of years to put all the temperature data together to show that the world had warmed from the late 19th century to about 1940.
Well, let's step back a bit. I mean, what is temperature? What is the thermometer actually measuring?
Well, the thermometer is measuring air temperature, is our main thing. You can obviously have thermometers measuring other things, like the temperature of the sea, the temperature in lakes, etc. What most people were interested in the first part of the 20th century, and even up to about 1980, was the temperature measured on land, which we refer to as air temperature. And it's measured in little sort of white-housed little huts, not small huts. They're called Stevenson screens. So they're designed to protect the thermometer from the direct rays of the sun, but just to measure the temperature of the air. So this screen has a louvered shield around it, so the air can circulate, and the thermometer can respond to the air and not to the direct rays of the sun. The idea is that if you get enough of these together around the world, you will put together a global picture. And a lot of people thought at the time, during the 20th century up to the 1960s, that this wasn't that important because they were more interested in forecasting the day-to-day changes in the weather rather than this longer-term aspects of climate.
And do we now have a standard time map of temperature, say, since the 1870s?
Yeah, we do, from about 1850, in fact. And we have a number of different components of this. So, as I mentioned, there's the air temperatures over the land. But we realized fairly early on when we started in about 1980 that the land is only 30% of the surface of the Earth. So 70% is oceans. And you need to include a number of measurements of sea temperatures as well, the proxy for air temperatures, because there's not enough islands around the world. There's vast areas of the oceans without islands. So in order to get a true global picture, you need to bring together air temperatures measured on land and sea temperatures measured in the ocean surface, called sea surface temperatures, and they then are a proxy for the air temperature over the ocean.
What are some of the tools used to reconstruct temperature records before the invention of the thermometer in the early 1700s?
Well, one other bit that's interesting is how the records were taken in the 17th and 18th centuries. They're mainly in Europe, and they gradually extended to other parts of the world with European colonization of places. So records in North America might begin in the late 18th century, and maybe where you are, they begin about 1850. But in other parts of the world, like Africa, they only begin in the late 19th century because there's just not enough measurements made, particularly in the interior of Africa, until that time. Most of the observations in Africa and South America were around the coast. And that's also the case in parts of India and Australia as well. So Europe is unique in having these long records going back to the late 17th century and into the 18th century.
Well, that brings me to my next question, because you investigated the concepts embodied in the terms medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age. Phil Jones, how important were those events, and are they part of climate change?
Well, if you look back in Europe, you can go back to about 1700 with a number of temperature series. But that's only 300 years to the year 2000. So what we thought and realized, it would be good to try and extend temperatures back in time. And we wanted to find various proxy sources that were capable of doing this. And there are a number. We might come to discuss some of these, like trees, coral records in the tropics, ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic. And there are other records from lake sediments and sea sediments that can provide different measures of temperature. But the important thing to remember with these records is that they're biological with trees and they're sort of biological as well with corals. And when the snow falls in Greenland, they're measuring some measure of the temperature then, but they're not equivalent to thermometers. So they're not measuring temperature all the time. For example, trees are mainly responding to what happens in the summer months of the year, the spring and summer months, and they don't tell us anything about the winter months. And this is important because we know from the instrumental record for the last 150 years that, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, because of its greater land area, the winters have a much more variable from winter to winter than our summers from one summer to the next. So we try to put together records of past temperature reconstructed from these various types of natural proxies. We also have other proxies too from where civilizations have written down things about the past. So these are mainly in Europe and China and Japan and Korea, where there's long written histories. So people can write things down about when rivers froze, when snow fell, how good the harvests were. And so they're year-to-year proxies in a comparable way to trees. But then they're all nowhere near as good as the instrumental data, which is telling you things about the days of the year, the months of the year, and not just one particular season. So when it comes to trying to piece all this together and look at the past, we really want to have records that can tell us things on the year-to-year timescale. And at the time of us doing some of this early work around the 1980 period, there had been concepts put forward about the pre-instrumental period. And one of these was the medieval period, say from about 950 AD to about 1250 or maybe 1300, was warmer than maybe later centuries. And that there was a period later from about 1550 to 1850 that was cooler than in the years in the 20th century. So the important thing to remember, though, is that these concepts came from work done in the 1960s or even earlier, when we had very little evidence about what was happening in the past. Now we have orders of magnitude more data than we had in the 1960s and 70s in terms of tree ring series, coral series, ice core series, documentary series, and the other proxies I've mentioned. So really, when we get all this extra data, the concepts we had of the past in the 1960s and 70s ought to gradually change with that new evidence. But even most paleoclimatologists who work with this data still use these terms, medieval warm period and little ice age, even though they're a bit pejorative in their terms, in that you obviously think the medieval warm period was somehow warmer and the little ice age was colder than some absolute level. But you've got to bear in mind that these records are not perfect like the instrumental data, and the medieval warm period appears to be a period in the medieval times which was relatively warm, but almost all the proxies are telling you things about the summer months of the year because it relates to crop yields, tree growth, etc. And the Little Ice Age is similar to some extent, but we do have a few more proxies for the winter months of the year from things like freezing of rivers and freezing of canals in the Netherlands that can give us a bit more of a clue to how winters varied in the past. So the medieval warm period and Little Ice Age are important periods, but I think they're overused because people seem to believe that because they're mostly proxies of summer, they are somehow proxies of the annual average. And the instrumental record tells us that that is not always the case. There are periods, even in the period from 1850 onwards, when you have very warm summers and you might have colder winters at the same time. And so the annual average is going to combine those two particular types of signal.
What are some of the problems of constructing a good temperature record for China?
Well, we always thought that we know that there's good records in China. There's obviously the long documentary series that I was talking about earlier, and this does have records back for over 1,000 years, and a few places have records beyond that in the various dynastic records. And one of the things of using them is you've got to make sure that they are telling you, well, different people in different centuries are telling you the same thing about what they're measuring. So, for example, if they're measuring some yields of crops, it might be that the crop variety has changed slightly over time, and that is sort of hidden within those different observers who will have a typical human lifespan of maybe 50 years at that time. So what someone would say about the crop yield in the 13th century might be different from what someone would say in the 18th century. So you've got to bear in mind that although it might be good on the year-to-year timescale in terms of good years and bad years for harvest, it might be less good on the century timescale when you're looking at different centuries hundreds of years apart. And this is why the winter records of freezing of rivers, etc., are very good, because freezing occurs at a fixed temperature, 0 degrees Celsius. So we know that humans a long time ago would have noticed the same thing that humans would notice now if a particular river froze or a canal froze.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my special guest, Dr. Phil D. Jones from the University of East Anglia, where he directed the Climatic Research Unit for 20 years. Phil is an authority on temperature records. Well, let's return to Europe, Phil. Was there really a Dark Ages cold period back in, say, the years 500 or 600 AD? And was the primitive state of governments and culture in Europe during the Dark Ages perhaps a reflection of a climatic period?
Well, when we look back over Europe, we have obviously the long instrumental records, and this enables us to look at the proxy records in a much longer calibration period, if you think of it that way. So we can look at trees growing from 1750 to 1950, so 200 years of tracking the trees and tracking the temperatures, whereas in other parts of the world, that overlap is considerably shorter and generally less than about 100 years. So we have a number of long records, though, in Europe, and particularly in the more northern parts of Europe, where the trees are dominant in terms of they're providing reconstructions. It's not to say that trees in southern Europe don't provide reconstructions, but because it's warmer in the Mediterranean areas, the trees there are responding more to changes in moisture from year to year as the temperature is warm enough. Whereas in Scandinavia and northern Russia, the trees are responding to temperatures because that's the main limiting factor to their growth. Whereas in the Mediterranean, it's precipitation amounts. And we have a number of potential reconstructions from trees going back several millennia in northern Sweden and northern Finland, and also in northwestern Russia as well. And in looking at these many years ago, we noticed that there were, in the 6th century, there were two really narrow years in 536 and 542. And we believe that these are typical signature years from very cold temperatures during the summer, which come in Europe often after severe volcanic eruptions. For example, there's Krakatoa, and there's another big eruption in 1258 and 1601. So these years tend to lead to very cold summers in northern Europe. And in the 6th century, there were tended to be more volcanic eruptions in this century than in centuries before, as you go back towards the Roman times. And there were other eruptions in the 7th and 8th centuries as well. So when we're looking at this, you're looking at the factors that might influence the climate. So obviously one of those is the sun. The sun's output does vary. But also, if you have a large volcanic eruptions putting dust in the upper parts of the atmosphere, this then cools the surface and leads to these severe effects for 3 or 4 years after major volcanic eruptions. And so if you have more volcanic eruptions in certain centuries than others, then you will get sort of periods that appear cooler over a longer time frame of maybe 50 years to 100 years than other centuries which have hardly any volcanic eruptions. So this Dark Ages cold period is named because of it's in the Dark Ages period, which is the period after Rome collapsed in Italy and moved to Constantinople. But we believe that a number of major volcanic eruptions occurred in the 6th century, and there were a few more in the 7th century. This is why this period's become known as the Dark Ages cold period, because of these volcanic eruptions. And we can see more volcanic eruptions later during the Little Ice Age period, from about 1550 to 1850, and we can also see fewer volcanic eruptions during the medieval period from about 950 to 1250. So maybe the medieval period was slightly warmer because there were fewer volcanic eruptions, and the Little Ice Age was cooler, and the Dark Ages cold period was also cooler because of more volcanic eruptions. But this is just one theory. We also know that solar output was potentially greater during the medieval period than it was in later centuries from some of the long reconstructions of solar output that have been speculatively produced.
Well, over the last 35 or more years, you've published over 400 papers, and you have a really global and wide-ranging nature to your research. In 2017, for example, you co-authored a paper on wildfires in Borneo. What is the difference, then, between a climatic drought and a hydrological drought? Aren't they both just caused by lack of rain or snow?
In principle, yes. But there's also a meteorological drought. There's another definition, which is the lack of rainfall for 30 or 40 days in Northern Europe. A lot of these definitions come from Northern Europe and maybe parts of North America, and they're less applicable in other parts of the world where you have a more climate in terms of in the tropics, particularly of rainy seasons and wet seasons. So in terms of a climate drought and a hydrological drought, these two are not that different, but they're also bringing into the mix the changes in evaporation as well. So drought isn't just the lack of precipitation. It's often exacerbated by the clear skies and the warm temperatures that go along with the lack of precipitation in many parts of the world. So if you combine the precipitation amounts and the evaporation amounts, then you get an idea of the sort of water balance, and that's more of a hydrological drought. And that's what we were doing in that paper in Borneo, is that when there's more hydrological droughts, when there's less rain and higher temperatures, then you have more potential fuel available on the ground to start fires in this part of the world, in Borneo, not deliberately, but by thunderstorms and lightning.
And some of those smoke fires were tremendous. They went as far as Malaysia in recent years, yes.
Some of the ones in recent years have, what the ones here in Borneo are more naturally started. But some of the smoke that went over Malaysia and Singapore from Indonesia are often from humans burning the forests to clear the forests of native vegetation in order to plant palm trees. So it's a clearance effect in Sumatra and maybe parts of Java as well.
Sadly, Phil, this year you had to help write a memoriam to your colleague Keith R. Briefa. Tell us about the man and why his work matters.
Well, this was a shock to me when he died a couple of years ago in October 2017, because I'd shared an office with him for 25 years, so you get to know someone very well in that sort of you're working together. Keith had been working principally on the tree rings, and he'd done a lot of initiatives in how to process tree ring data to ensure that you had this good year-to-year agreement between the trees, and you'd removed all the biological influences of growth trends. So trees, long-lived trees, do gradually put on smaller rings as the rings get more on the edge of the disc of a tree growth. And Keith was one of the main people who has written a number of key papers that are still used today by dendroclimatologists to look at trees. First of all, how well they agree with one another, then ensuring that they're principally looking at past temperatures or past precipitation events. And I think if you look at his papers, you'll find that virtually every tree ring paper written today will refer to two or three of his papers, because people are still using the concepts that he developed during the 1980s and 1990s and extended during his career until his untimely death in 2017.
And we also recently lost in February the American scientist Wallace Smith Brocker, the man credited with coining the term global warming, and he also established a great knowledge about the ocean conveyor belt. In his last message to scientists at a group of scientists at the University of Arizona, Wally Brocker called for more research quickly into geoengineering to shade the planet. Phil, do you think we're approaching such a dire need, and what do you think about it?
I met Wally a couple of times. He's a charming man, very very knowledgeable man. And I'm often asked about this same sort of question about the climate's changing and what are we going to do about it. And obviously the things we've got to do are to reduce the amounts of carbon dioxide and methane entering the atmosphere. So we've got to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and replace that with renewables and probably also nuclear power initially. But in terms of Wally's ideas about doing something more positive, doing something more...
Proactive. Let's call it proactive.
A proactive way in trying to cool the planet by putting enough sort of material in the upper atmosphere, sort of putting up there a sort of constant volcano to reduce the amount of radiation reaching the surface, which would cool the planet. Now, the problem with this idea is, in theory, it's a good thing, but we know from the volcanic examples that although the volcanoes go off in different parts of the world, and we're talking particularly here about tropical volcanoes, their effects are more global in scale, but they're not always in the same place, the effects, I mean, of where the cooling occurs. And I'm sure that if we started doing this, we probably would cool the planet down slowly. It's going to take a long time. But then you will have people saying that you have caused some different sorts of extremes in terms of droughts or floods or heat waves and cold spells, and that you've got to somehow, someone would have to take the blame for those. And is that the sort of science of the world or the governments of the world who initiated these schemes to try and cool the planet with a sort of continual volcano? It also assumes that we know fully what's going to happen in the future with in terms of temperature change if we continue to burn fossil fuels. We know the temperature is going to go up, but do we know how much it's going to go up and go up where? It might go up much more in the polar regions, for example, than the tropics. But in order to look at this effect of trying to cool the planet proactively, I think we don't know enough in order to put that scheme forward and be confident with the outcome we're going to get. I mean, we have, in effect, had a sort of proactive experiment going on with the burning of fossil fuels, and we're now going to then try another proactive experiment with putting dust in the atmosphere to cool the planet. And I think we need to know more about the first one, which was inadvertent, before we go to the second one.
Many of us will not live to see the dangerous inheritance we leave to coming generations. In a strange way, I'm almost disappointed. I may not live to see climate science fully vindicated or society acting to save itself. Does that bother you, Phil Jones?
It doesn't bother me that much because I know that I'm 66, so I haven't got too many more years on this planet. But I know that my grandchildren have, and I know that my children and my grandchildren are going to have to take responsibility at some point for what we've done as a generation and what previous generations have done in increasing the average temperature of the world and making some areas less habitable than others. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of work done in the future, and it's got to be done in a competent way, like I was talking about earlier with the proactive ways, so that we really know what we're doing. We've got to follow it through with modeling studies, observational studies, etc., and we've got to be monitoring the planet continually in the future, improving our understanding of how the climate works so that we can then follow through in the models as to what we're doing and what is happening and whether it's going on with how we expected it to go on. But one thing I feel very interested about recently is that there's a number of groups in different parts of Europe and the Americas and Australia and maybe other countries where younger people are realizing that this is going to be a massive problem for them in their lifetimes. And these school strikes, trying to raise interest amongst the politicians who have the ability to do something. So I think it's really positive with these children, and started by this Swedish child, it's really positive that they are going to push this agenda, and maybe the governments of the world will take notice. It's clear that some government leaders are taking no notice whatsoever and think they know everything. But I think there's going to be a few surprises along the way, and I wish I was 40 years younger and I could see more of it, like you were saying, but I'm not. But I think it's going to be a greater and greater interest amongst scientists in the future. And so I would recommend anyone who's of school age, that this is a fantastic career to have got into, that I got into inadvertently in 1977. And it's going to be a very important continuing career in future decades.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. From the University of East Anglia, we have been talking with Dr. Phil Jones, professorial fellow at the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia. And as you can see from this interview, much more over his long career. Phil, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A special hello to dozens of listeners from St. Hyacinth, Canada, and Wallingford, Connecticut, tuning in through Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page this week. If that's you, drop me a line. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You can also listen to or download each and every new Radio EcoShock show, going back years if you want, absolutely free, posted every Wednesday at the show website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, learning, and loving this amazing planet. Join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.